We have a physical therapy day here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us. Today we're talking about the role of placebos in the study of pain management. To begin the show, of course, we'll be taking all of your questions as well. But we have some insight to share from our physical therapist, Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum. Jill, good to see you.
It's great to be here.
And Lori Tyne-Brody.
Hello. Awesome to be here.
Jill's a professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Laura's a physical therapist at UW Health's Mind Physical Therapy Clinic. And what physical therapy questions do you have for our guests? You can join in. Easy to do. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. The you two sent me some research on placebos. It was fascinating me. Well, first, I suppose I think people know what placebos are, but how are they used in medical kinds of situations?
Well, let's just clarify and make sure people know what a placebo is. And it's a phenomena where a person experiences a positive change in either their physical or mental state after receiving some treatment that really has no inherent effect. Exactly.
Right.
It's the quintessential sugar pill.
Right.
And it's used often in research to compare against an actual intervention. So, you know, in, for example, osteoarthritis that we were discussing here before we got on the air, people use it to compare physical therapy to a placebo. They test taping against a placebo taping. They have sham surgeries.
Yeah.
And interestingly, in osteoarthritis, there was a study where they did an arthroscopic procedure and they compared it to a sham surgery. And shockingly, the results were the same. And the benefit in both groups exceeded what we call the minimally clinically important difference. So it wasn't like, oh, they both got a little bit better. They both got a lot better.
Right. And it was a double-blinded study. So the patients had no idea which group they were in. So there wasn't that factor of mentally knowing, oh, I had a procedure or, oh, I didn't have a procedure. They were blinded to what happened when they did
and they were actually cut.
Correct.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly.
They went into the OR. They had an arthroscopic device put in. So the arthroscope was put in, probably looked around their knee, but did not address or fix what the surgeon saw.
Right. So that brings up the point about what we call contextual factors. And those are all the things surrounding your episode of care that are really difficult to measure, including your engagement with your provider, the amount of attention that's given to you, whether or not you are physically touched by your provider. And interestingly, there was a study looking at pain, at the study of morphine for post-operative pain. Patients reported lower pain when that same medication was administered by a human as compared to an automated,
like PC pump.
Yeah, like a PC pump, like a pain control pump. So, you know, a person listening, that compassion that you have, you know, as a provider, any intervention we provide has to be better than what we call the natural history, and that is the time for most people to get better. So, for example, they've done these studies on tennis elbow, and over time, most people get better. And the same can be true with a variety of other conditions. And so if we're administering a treatment, it has to really be superior to the natural history. And we know that most people get better over time regardless.
Yeah.
And so what makes it really hard to measure? So patients come in and they're like, well, you know, I have arthritis in my knee. Can't you get me better? I'm like, well, yes, but we don't really know how much our interventions are actually doing. And if we don't take into consideration those contextual factors, such as my listening to that patient, and I can't tell you how many times I have a patient say to me, "You really listened to me today. You heard what I had to say." And that makes a huge difference. You know, did you place your hands on that patient? Did you listen to their concerns as compared to, well, you have osteoarthritis on x-rays, and so here's your treatment program, without really engaging with that patient.
And interesting to me that there were patients that, if you looked at two patients, patient A might be, according to the x-rays or whatever that was done, would be in worse shape than the patient B. But
absolutely,
patient B is experiencing more pain than patient A.
Correct. So, and those are the things that we don't understand, and that's where we get to our social determinants of health and how your perhaps mental approach to this is, how supported you are by your family and friends. I think to Lori's point, one of the things when you are working with a patient as a healthcare provider, something that I always try to do and emphasize is this rehabilitation program was designed for you. So, yes, I know that your friends also have osteoarthritis, and they may come in and say, well, why am I doing these exercises and they're doing those exercises? Because our goal is to match our exercises or our rehabilitation approach to your impairments or individualize it to the person. And I think that's really important for patients to understand, and also probably why getting handed the pamphlet from the physician that has general exercises in it may not be beneficial to everyone.
Right. It may hit a certain subgroup.
Right.
Some people may respond to that. And you'll see in the research, for example, patients with low back pain, there's research that shows that a certain percentage of them respond to just a walking program. Just go out and walk. And they're like, oh, yeah, I'm all better. Some people will get better with that for reasons, again, that we still don't understand. But yet there's a large group of people who don't get better. And every day I see this with people who have imaging, have pretty clean imaging, and have lots of symptoms.
Correct.
Generally dismissed by the medical community as, yeah, there's nothing wrong with that.
It's all in their head.
It's all in your head. And
well, in some ways, maybe it is kind of in their head.
The mental approach, you mean, or their mental attitude towards it? Maybe.
Maybe. You know what we love to say in medicine? It's complicated.
It depends.
Yeah, it depends. And so because there are so many variables in this Venn diagram, that saying, oh, this is in your head, you just need to deal with it, that's not the right approach. It's understanding, trying to help figure out a way to help them overcome the symptoms that they're having for whatever reason they are having them.
And one of the things that I always say to patients, for example, with low back pain, and they're going to have an MRI and they say, well, I have mixed emotions. I don't know if I wanted to show anything or not because you don't know. When an MRI comes back, as Lori alluded to, relatively clean, meaning there's not a lot going on there, one of the things that I always consider with my patients, and I have this discussion with them, is you, and this, if this is the case with the patient, you primarily experience your pain when your joints are loaded. And imaging is done, for the most part, non-weight bearing. And so we don't know what happens to that little,
that extra pressure.
Right.
Is that a significant enough change that can cause your pain? So so I try to help, because they feel so unvalidated
when they get
a clean image, to be like, well, why on earth am I having this pain then? And so sometimes I think that can be a factor with people.
Right. It's funny. I had a patient last week ask me that very question.
Really?
Like, well, is it because of the position I was in when I was getting my MRI? So that is certainly something to consider. And we know, again, going back to this relationship between imaging and pathology, we know when MRI was first developed and they were trying to learn what normal anatomy looked like, they imaged all these spines in, no, I always say normal, but people without symptoms, asymptomatic adults, and fully 50% of them had pathology on MRI. Mm-hmm. None of them had symptoms.
I would, when I said it could be in their head, what I was thinking was their brain. There are just different things in people's brains that can be different from one person to another, and it's not that they're trying to get sympathy or something mm-hmm. like that.
Right, and that's called centrally mediated pain, and that can be a condition where any touch, any
stimulus,
thank you, Lori.
You're welcome.
Goes to your brain and is perceived as pain. So you touch them with a feather, that's pain. You compress mm-hmm. it, that's pain. As opposed to somebody who doesn't have that centrally mediated pain, they know what a feather feels like. They know what a nociceptive, painful stimulus feels like. But there's some miswiring here in the brain where every sensation, every stimulus is perceived to be pain.
Roy in Two Creeks has something relating to this, so let's go there. Roy, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hey, hello there, Larry. And I didn't catch the name of the presenter, but I'm a physician, and I'm so thankful for hearing what I have heard so far, for this compassionate, understanding approach to our patients compared to what sometimes has happened in traumatized patients. In my experience, and I have a couple questions here for you, because I have seen, like all these studies, there are things that don't seem to make sense. And then two things I question you about, because I have seen responses to homeopathic remedies mm-hmm. that appear to me to be beyond placebo, and two, even as dramatic or more dramatic than anything I've ever seen, are faith healings. And what is your experience about those two things, in mm-hmm. addition to careful listening, all the good care? Are those things possibly beyond just placebo?
Yeah, thank you for calling, Roy.
Well, first of all, thank you for validating kind of the care in patient care. We all know how important that is. So when you think about evidence-based practice, one of the legs on a three-legged stool is the patient's values and beliefs. Mm-hmm. And so if someone has had a positive experience with some sort of homeopathic care or some sort of particular faith healing, something like that, then that's something that they might value and put a little bit more weight in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my approach is, as long as it's not absolutely contraindicated and it's something that the patient values and believes, I like to know that they're doing it, so I'm aware of it. So it kind of goes into this comprehensive rehabilitation program. But I see more and more people with those kind of approaches.
Absolutely. And again, so the three-legged stool, for people who don't know evidence-based practice, it is research, it is provider experience, and patient beliefs mm-hmm. and input. And so on the research side, like, we just went through a lot of research that shows that the placebo is very dramatic. I'm not sure how anyone would know a response is beyond what a placebo would be, because a placebo effect can be pretty darn profound. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was as great as an arthroscopic surgery. In fact, they've done heart surgery. I don't know if you could do it here, but in the UK,
correct,
they did sham heart surgeries, and people again did just as well as those who had the real surgery. So absolutely, if this works and it fits with that belief system, and if you look at what are the social determinants of health, faith healing, homeopathy, those can check a lot of those mm-hmm. boxes.
Right.
So thank you for that call.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Our guest today, Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic, and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. questions for them. I hope you'll join in. Could be relating to placebo effects. Could be just ache or pain issue that you're dealing with. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at 12:30, we'll talk about the engineering marvel that is the Erie Canal with author Lori Lawler, who has written a fascinating new book titled Many Voices, Building Erie, the Canal That Changed America. Right now, we're dealing with physical therapy with Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Great to have them back. And again, questions, give a call at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. And let's take a call. Tim in Madison, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, to tell you the truth, I was listening to the placebo part, and I thought there were going to be people testifying that PT was placebo. I was very glad to find differently in the world, because for me, I was a very much disbeliever until recently when I had hip problems and talked to my doctor about it. And he said, well, we can send you to orthopedics or we can, you know, send you to PT and see what they think. And I was kind of like, well, little gun before big gun, right?
You know? Good call. It's a really good idea.
So, yeah, yeah. So I just wanted to share with you that I went to, can I share names or is that?
I don't care.
No good.
That's fine.
Okay. Well, anyway, there's a wonderful therapist who had worked on my wife's frozen shoulder, and her name is Judy Mufti. Strange as it may sound.
We know Judy.
I know Judy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I went in there unhappy with my doctor because I was thinking that I was having, you know, horrible joint business that needed to be corrected, and he said, "No, you know, your X-ray says you have, you know, relatively mild, you know," and he recommended that I try that before I went to the big guns. So that's what I did. And I just wanted to throw out something that Judy helped me understand, because she's a good listener. And Judy helped me understand that the things that I needed to do were related not so much to, you know, something in my head as to something in my body that I just needed to tend to, like clipping your toenails, you know? And so I just wanted to shout out to Judy and to you guys that I misunderstood the purpose of the show, and PT is certainly not a placebo.
Thank you for that. That's amazing.
That's great. And again, you hit on it, that Judy listened to you, because people come in with their own worldview about all kinds of things, about their body, about their relationship with the provider that sent them to you, about their potential relationship with you. And as a provider, you really have to listen to kind of get to the crux of what is it that this person needs. Maybe they need to understand their body better. Maybe they just need someone to listen to them. Maybe they need suggestions about how to modify what they already do in their life. So not all patients who come in with hip pain need the same thing.
Right. Absolutely.
Know, they may get the same exercises, but how we get from point A to point B is often very different.
Yeah. Tim, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Bill in Barnes, Wisconsin. Hey, Bill.
Good morning, Larry. This is kind of a thank you note that's a little bit like the preceding caller. About a year ago, I called, I'm pretty sure these same guests were on, with knee and hip pain. They said I should go see a physical therapist. And interestingly, when I went to the doctor to get the referral, he said, you know, too many people wait too long to seek physical therapy. He said, I commend you for coming before you're all bent over and can't walk. But anyway, she examined me, gave me, I think there were six visits, and I've been doing my 20-minute routine almost every day, and it really has chased the knee and hip pain away. So thanks to your guests for the recommendation.
Well, Bill, thank you for calling.
I love that story. And you know what I love about it? I mean, many things I love about it, but that he's still doing his exercises.
Right.
It was a year ago.
As you should.
That he called.
Right.
And those are the people who are successful. So often we see people get better and then, oh, they kind of drop off. Mm-hmm. And you'd be surprised at how quickly something like knee pain or hip pain can rear its ugly head mm-hmm. again if you don't keep up with it.
Right.
And as I said to somebody not long ago, somebody who has now has joined a center and is continuing to exercise, if I can take a patient who's relatively sedentary and turn them into a regular exerciser, that's the best thing I can do for that person mm-hmm. because exercise has benefits in just about every aspect of your health, physical, mm-hmm. mental, social, you name it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Bill, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it.
I'm liking this show, Larry. Mm-hmm. This is kind of fun. Some fun call.
Well, we got Beth in Cottage Grove with an email to say Beth's been having right knee pain for several months, an x-ray months. An x-ray shows close to bone on bone in inner compartment and behind the mm-hmm. patella. Mm-hmm. Beth's PT didn't help and cortisone didn't help. Their doctor feels hyaluronic mm-hmm. acid
injections
are not conclusive, so doesn't recommend it.
Mm.
Surgery seems to be her only option. Mm. Any comments?
Well, in the big picture, hyaluronic acid injections have been proven to be effective in the knee more so than in other joints such mm-hmm. as the hip and things like that. Now, without seeing Beth's imaging and things like that, and maybe there are other factors that go into this, why her mm-hmm. physician is hesitant to use
right.
the hyaluronic acid injection. So it sounds like she has not tri-compartmental, but bicompartmental mm-hmm. DJD. So she's got it in two of the three compartments. So maybe that's a factor.
Well, it could be. I mean, the hyaluronic acid, the Synvisc, mm-hmm. you know, was the brand name, will help with the medial compartment, but not so much the patellofemoral compartment because it's extra articular.
Mm, correct.
So maybe the patellofemoral compartment's a mess. If Beth hasn't tried exercise in a pool or aquatic PT, that would be another option to see if she can be more successful in an unweighted or minimally weighted environment to do strengthening. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people cannot achieve a sufficient volume of exercise on land because of ongoing pain.
Right.
So it limits our ability to really get them stronger and affect a change. So sometimes getting in a pool allows them to exercise at a greater volume, and sometimes that can help jumpstart their land program that then becomes more successful.
Right.
Just another option. The other option is an unloader brace.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, and I'm not sure of Beth's age, so that would be a factor mm-hmm. In terms of deciding whether or not to go forward mm-hmm. with
and,
surgery.
And before I'd even try an unloader brace, I may try a wedge in the shoe.
Oh, yeah, lateral
so
wedge.
So that seems mm-hmm. that's like a lowest hanging fruit mm-hmm. to me. It's very inexpensive,
mm-hmm.
But you have to be cognizant of back pain and things like that. And I do agree with you, Lori. You know, if she's got arthritic changes in her patellofemoral joint,
mm-hmm.
I'm guessing she's probably having a really hard time getting her quadriceps stronger.
Right to fire.
And,
yeah.
and
yep.
then it's
yep.
hard to offload the
mm-hmm.
joint.
Yep.
So,
yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
yeah.
It, they sort of, yeah. It's
I was just remembering my own with Synvisc. And it's, and I'm not sure of the timing on this. She said the last couple of months. But I remember when I went through my series of shots, it took a while for the full effect of
correct.
The mm-hmm. shots to take effect,
correct.
Too.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Whether or not that is the case in
her. Interestingly, she had a cortisone shot, and it didn't seem to help.
Correct.
So, I mean, typically, at least cortisone will buy you a little bit of time. But again, that could have been intraarticular and still left the patellofemoral joint not addressed.
If her under-the-kneecap pain is really the driving mm-hmm. force, that's probably the problem.
Yeah.
Mm. Tom in Howard has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. Ever since I had PMR a few years ago, and ever since then, my balance hasn't been as good.
Mm.
Can you recommend any exercises to improve balance?
That's a great question, especially in the state of Wisconsin, because unfortunately we are number one in falls.
Yes, we are.
And we know that falls leads to just a real downward cascade.
And what's PMR?
Polymyalgia rheumatica.
So and multiple muscle rheumatica.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in terms of balance, yes, there are many things you can do. I would say you need to see somebody because there are multiple reasons why you could be having balance issues. It could be strength. It could be vestibular. It could be coordination. There are just a number of factors that go into balance and stability. So treating the right source of those symptoms makes sense. Now, given your history of polymyalgia rheumatica, I would also say a pool is a great place to work on your balance while unloading your joints from buoyancy. You get resistance moving against it, but the pool slows everything down. And we can also do a lot of things on a single leg that people are unable to do on land because they can't manage pain-wise standing on a single leg. But those are things we can do in a pool. So that would be another option for Tom in terms of getting an exercise program. There are also, depending upon where you live, the YMCA or local pools will often have a class that focuses on balance. So just a community class in a pool working on balance. Usually it'd be like an aqua yoga or an aqua Tai Chi or an aqua strength and balance kind of class would be another option to supplement whatever a physical therapist might give him.
Yeah. Well, good points, Tom. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Stephen Wapan, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Larry. Question for your guest. A couple of people ago, you talked about a good basic exercise program. My wife and I are 70. We have two golden retrievers, walk at least 2 miles a day. What more could or should we be doing on top of that for that baseline that you guys sort of are describing? Or are we right on track of where we need to be?
No, there's always room.
How much time do you have, Steve?
There's always room for improvement. So walking your golden retrievers 2 miles a day is a great start. But things that you... What I would recommend to do to supplement this is, first of all, resistance training. There's no strength training in there, and walking isn't going to do anything for your upper extremities. So for maintaining an potentially increasing bone mineral density, some sort of resistance training is really important. And research has shown that... I don't want to use the word elderly.
exactly, because we can see that from here.
Yes, we can. But I'm going to say experienced people can tolerate heavy loads.
Oh, yeah.
So it used to be that, you know, we would see a 70-year-old lady and we'd have her do a straight leg raise with a one-pound weight. And that may be where you need to start, but we know now that you can and should be loading people as they age to prevent sarcopenia. So weights for sure, probably some balance, maybe different cardio.
Yeah, people in their 80s and 90s strength training, and there's more and more research in terms of general health, cardiovascular health, cancer, all the big killers in older age that benefit from resistive training. So I would absolutely do that. And particularly for your wife who needs to maintain her bone density.
Right.
So, yeah. And then balance and flexibility. American College of Sports Medicine, if you go online and look up the American College of Sports Medicine exercise guidelines, they lay out precisely what you should be doing and they do it by age group.
Right. I think it's ACSM.org.
Yeah. Yeah.
And having said that, seeing a physical therapist to get a program started or designed for a couple visits, maybe to train you to go to a gym like you had mentioned, Lori, would be a great idea.
Yeah, yeah, especially if you're having like a history of knee pain or back pain or shoulder pain. Because what often happens is people will start a program and they'll hurt themselves and then they'll stop.
Then they quit.
Yeah.
And Steve, I can tell you, yesterday I was watching the Brewers.
Oh, as we all were.
And as I have two 5-pound weights next to the next to my couch.
Love it. It's perfect.
And I was working more rapidly at times.
Right, of course. Exactly. You do ballistic weight training when the brewers go behind and things like that. No, it's great. Those are great little things to do.
You can just do that while you're watching TV.
Right, exactly.
So that's my own little extra weight training.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, absolutely wonderful.
Thanks again, Steve. Appreciate it very much. And where's that? Where should he go?
ACSM.
Yep.
.org. It's the American College of Sports Medicine.
ACSM.
Yep.
.org.
Great.
There
it's
you go, Steve.
Wonderful nonprofit organization, mm-hmm. multidisciplinary, does a lot of research.
Yep.
All right. There you go, Steve. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. You know, you were talking earlier about tennis elbow, and you said that people with tennis elbow, I think the research was showing that, within a year,
that's right.
Everything is taken care of.
Yeah,
yeah.
On its own.
Yes.
Yep. And that's true of a fair number of things, like low back pain. You know, 6 to 8 weeks, most people get better. So, you call for that PT appointment. That's 8 weeks out, and guess what? Yeah, some people are going to be better by then. But yeah, so that's the point that your intervention has to be better than the natural history, than what you're treating.
But would you say then, all right, I've got tennis elbow, I guess I won't need to go and see anybody because it's a whole year ago, you know, I'll be better anyway?
That's a great question, because a lot of people don't have a year to wait. You know, they want to get back to whatever they're doing. It limits their ability to open a door, to lift a gallon of milk out of the fridge or whatever. So we try to use interventions that will speed up or accelerate that process. The point of that being, it's really hard to measure the impact of what we do because of the natural history of time. So that was the point we were trying to make. It isn't that, oh, you should just wait everything out. Particularly if there's something that you're doing that is perpetuating your symptoms. So, for example, your tennis elbow, maybe it's the grip on your hammer and you work work it with a hammer. Then let's talk about a different hammer handle size or a different weight hammer, or if you're playing tennis, how do we get you back to that activity? Do we need to make a change in your racket so that you're not perpetuating your symptoms? So one of the things that we would do is try to find out why you're having symptoms now and deal with that so that your body has a chance to heal itself.
So if you got tennis elbow and you go to see the PT, you should probably take your racket with you?
Take your racket with
exactly.
you.
I take all those things with you, all those tools and toys, because grip is such a huge factor in elbow tendinopathy and how you grip things. So that's really important. Something as simple as getting your racket restrung can change things significantly. Think about the long lever of putting a tennis racket in your hand. So that's a tricky one. I think in the category of tendinopathies, we could probably say that almost all of them, natural history, can get better in about a year. It's just when you get tendinosis and those degenerative changes in your tendon that just takes that long.
And you need somebody to explain look that over and explain that to you.
And help you with lifestyle factors to minimize those symptoms and prevent worsening the symptoms because of the way you're sitting, standing, moving, transitioning positions, et cetera.
Ron in Land O'Lakes has a question. Ron, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. So I have lower back pain. I've gone through physical therapy on and off. I've had injections in the back. But I'm now entering the stage where I'm getting a back stimulator. I had a trial stimulator put in to see how it works, and it was wonderful. It definitely treats things. But the question I have is, because I know the stimulator is more for nerve pain rather than muscle pain, but I also have muscle pain, right? When I do something I shouldn't be doing, let's say. Does a back stimulator also, can it also help reduce the pain in the muscle, just, you know, versus the nerve pain like it's supposed to? I'm just curious.
I don't think we know the answer to that question. Right. So I just to be perfectly honest.
What is the stimulator?
It's an implantable electrode that they implant in the so yes. And they usually do a trial run like Ron alluded to. And then it's for lack of better terms, I'm gonna say it's almost like constant gating of your pain.
Right.
And so you get a different stimulus sent to your brain other than that nerve related pain that Ron was referring to. You can change the settings and the intensities and things like that, but it's implanted as opposed to something on
like,
your surface.
Like a TENS unit.
Right.
It's like an implanted TENS unit,
yes.
For lack of a better term.
Yes.
And Ron, I don't know that we know precisely how it works. It's a little bit of a black box. We understand the theory of the gait theory of pain, and that's what we're functioning on, and then it works, and we go, yahoo,
great.
That's awesome. But whether or not it's impacting just the nerve or the muscles, it's way more complicated than that. When you start stimulating stuff in the spine,
correct?
Yeah,
but
feel free to jump in.
But the take-home message is, I think what the intent is trying to break that vicious cycle of pain, and so maybe now Ron can move more, maybe get a little stronger, be more flexible, all of those things, so that constant cycling of pain is what we're trying to disrupt.
So it could the muscle decrease in muscle pain could be secondary to his now ability to move because the nerve pain has been gated.
Sure.
Perhaps. We're just processing, coming up with the theory on the fly here, Ron.
Right.
So,
but
yeah.
The take-home message is, if it's working for you and you can do more things, function better, do some strengthening, things like that, that's really fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. Let us know. Because at this point, the muscle pain you're having could easily be a response to the nerve pain that you're having. So we don't really know until you get that in there and you work with it for a while and you see what happens to the muscle pain that you have.
Yeah.
You let us know.
Yeah.
So
see if our theory
something
is
like that is not going to, all right, it eases the pain, but if it eases the pain, could there be a situation where you would overuse or somehow cause your more problems down the road? If you
so
see
you don't
what I'm
want
getting
to
at.
Mask the pain is the concern and then overdo it. So, for example, I don't want to take Advil because I'm afraid I'll hurt my shoulder more. If my pain goes away, maybe I'll overdo it. Is that
kind of what I was getting at?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question, and I don't know that I personally have never heard of anybody having that situation.
Circumstance, okay.
But that's a great question, Larry. I don't know that we know the answer to that.
Yeah.
Ron, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Go ahead and see what happens and let
us
know. Let us know for sure. Lori Tyne Brody, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our guests. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Tomorrow on the show, we've got three things. I mentioned Brewers earlier, and we'll be talking about the Brewers' great success with podcasters Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan. And we'll also look at canning and preserving food, and we'll talk about soil health. So we got all kinds of things
That's a lot going on tomorrow.
A lot going on tomorrow. But right now we're on to physical therapy, and Mary in Eau Claire has a question. So let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a question. I didn't listen to the very beginning of your program, so I don't know. Maybe I missed something important. But I'm wondering, I have actually a replacement for my hip scheduled in about a week. Hmm. And I'm kind of wondering, is there any chance at all at the Mayo Clinic? I don't know. I'm not sure. Are they going to go in there and maybe just pretend to do this?
No. So, but Mary brings up a really great question, Mary. So in order to do studies like that, you have to get those approved through an institutional review board, and they have to go through many, 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 many layers.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and the patient has to agree to be randomized to the real hip replacement or a sham hip replacement.
Correct.
So you would be informed and have a choice about whether or not you wanted to be randomized.
Correct. So yes. Yeah. So no, but that brings up a really good point that for clinical research, mm-hmm. if you want to participate in a study, you have to provide consent.
Informed consent.
Which is entirely different than just the conversation with your physician about do you want to proceed. This would look very, very different.
Yeah.
So Mary, it's actually a great question.
Yep.
Yeah,
it is.
Really good question.
Yeah, and you're probably going to be super happy with that
yes.
hip replacement.
Yes.
Most people who get a hip replacement are pretty darn happy when they walk
happy
out the door.
Happy campers. And you will walk out the door.
Yeah.
I would say that there are certain kinds of ailments or diseases where placebos are typically not progressive type of certain types of cancers, for example, there would not be a placebo
because
type
of, and
study.
That gets into the ethics mm-hmm. of doing treatments like that and withholding treatment or mm-hmm. providing a fake treatment to somebody who critically needs mm-hmm. it. So then an institutional review board wouldn't approve it because of the ethics mm-hmm. involved in that. So correct.
Yeah.
So clinical research is heavily, heavily scrutinized by an institutional review board. We have a huge one here at the University of Wisconsin
mm-hmm.
and they are fine-tooth combed to make sure that the number one concern they have is patient protection.
Yeah.
That's their role.
Yep.
Yeah. I remember reading about the first time they came up with a solution to, you know, if you're bitten by a rabid dog or something, a rabies,
mm-hmm.
that they went directly to the position, to the fix and mm-hmm. did not do mm-hmm. any kind of comparative
Correct.
Study.
Right. Yeah.
Those are situations where exactly you don't want, you know, life-threatening situations mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah, that's no place for a placebo.
Correct.
No. Mary, you're going to, I hope, love your hip surgery.
I think so, too. That'll be great.
Rich and Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Rich.
Hello. I wanted to ask the experts there. You had described some things that can help with arthritic problems in your joints, and they've developed problems in both of my hands where I can't grip things, and it started out with where I tried some carpal tunnel work on my right hand to get flexibility, but it's not helped with the swelling and the issues with trying to get my hands working right. But you had mentioned that we should continue I don't call it weight training, which I used to do. Right now, I am just with the help and direction with their therapists and my primary doctor that I've turned to just swimming and biking, and I've eliminated the weight training. And the swimming is great. It gets my aerobics up and all of that. But I used to do a lot of weight training, and the way my primary doctor put it after looking at all the results is, Rich, you're getting old. I'm 76, and things deteriorate, and so you have to work with it, and I'm fine with it. But I have this image in my mind that if I use the weight training, my joints are just disintegrating.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have some great weight machines that adjust the tension and smooth movements rather
mm-hmm.
than
mm-hmm.
lifting weight. So what should I be focusing with, I guess?
It's particularly lower extremity.
Correct.
So legs, glutes, you know, lower abs, things like that. Those are critically important for function, getting down and up from the floor, getting in and out of a chair, getting in and out of bed, going up and down stairs. So I don't see any reason why you shouldn't be doing anything in your lower extremities.
Correct.
And then, you know, in the upper, there are options. So, you know, there are some weight machines where you're not gripping with your hands, like you may be pushing or pulling with your entire arm, but not gripping. There's also...
So you got your hand open.
You got your hand open, yeah.
And there's also some cable columns where you can actually attach a band or a strap
around your wrist.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so you don't have to be gripping things. And so with some upper extremity modifications...
Right.
I think we could do
Yeah. I mean, I think about in our fitness center, and I think about things that we have available in our fitness center, and I'm certain our staff could design a program that hit the major muscle groups in the upper body without using a grip.
And Rich is in Eau Claire.
Should be something there.
Oh, sure. Especially, he already said he's swimming and biking, so might have access to that facility.
Right.
So this would be a nice addition to what he's already doing.
Yeah, and he must be doing something. If he's biking, he's weight-bearing on his hands.
Correct, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And without having to close his fist.
Correct,
right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I would absolutely try to find some resistive training to do to add to what you're already doing.
Good luck, Rich. Thank you for calling. Seal in Menominee, we go to you now. Hi, Seal.
Good morning. Can you hear me okay? I'm driving.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, thanks. A couple months ago, I was working out and sustained kind of what I think is a mild groin strain. I've been continuing to walk and bike. And I'm a long-distance hiker. Mm. I have a pretty strenuous hike coming up next month with a lot of elevation change. Mm. Mm. And I'm just curious if there's a way to better rehab that than what I've been doing so far. Because it doesn't bother me when I'm not actively doing anything. It probably is most uncomfortable at night, actually.
Yeah. So why do you think this was a groin strain? Do you remember a specific thing you were doing?
Yeah.
I was doing
like a side lunge.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So you're only a month away, but getting in to see a PT, is this primary groin strain? Is it pubic symphysis? Mm-hmm. Is it a primary hip problem? So there are a number of suspects when you have groin pain that could be the primary driver, and that's going to determine what the right rehab is. So apparently whatever you're doing is not hitting the mark. Jill's...
Right.
She's got her thinking face on.
Yes, she wants
to say something.
It's either the deer in the headlights face or the thinking face.
Yeah,
they're kind of similar.
Well, I
think what we don't always appreciate is we think about a groin strain and groin pathology only impacting side-to-side movement. And for Seal, who's hiking, she needs a lot of frontal plane stability when she's lifting one leg up, things like that. So seeing a physical therapist is highly recommended.
Seal, there you go.
Good luck with the hike.
Yeah. I think seeing somebody to sort out the primary source of this problem is going to be key.
Thank you very much for calling again, Seal. Appreciate your call. And you can join in as well. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us. The email address is talk@wpr.org. We've got rain coming down very hard in the Madison area.
I don't know what it's... And my door, my
French, I hope your
doors
windows aren't open.
They are open at home.
Those plants will be getting a nice drink.
I hope the dog knows how to close the door.
Don't slip in the water. Lori and Jill are going to be with us right up until 12:30. We'll take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. Then we'll get back to Peggy in Darlington, who's waiting, and then we'll get to you. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. It's another physical therapy day on WPR News. Thanks for joining in. Larry Mueller here with my guest physical therapist Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody. Great to have them back. And certainly if you have questions, maybe you've got an ache, a pain, a sprain, or a strain that you're dealing with, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. And let's, Peggy's been patiently waiting from Darlington, so let's go to Peggy right now. Peggy, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm just wondering if it's possible to repair the rotator cuff if a person has a failed anatomic total shoulder replacement.
I would say so. If it's an anatomic total shoulder replacement, they still have a rotator cuff, but
but it's your rotator cuff has subsequently failed after your anatomic. Have you had a shoulder replacement, Peggy?
Yes, I had the shoulder replacement in 2008, and it started having problems with it in 2017. But now it has definitely failed.
Okay. You know what I would do if I were you? I would get a reverse total shoulder replacement. You can switch an anatomic total shoulder. You could have a reverse total shoulder done. I know people who have had that done. I think that's what I would probably do, because a reverse total shoulder is indicated for people who have irreparable massive rotator cuff tears, and the outcomes are pretty darn good for reverse total shoulders. So I think I would talk to my orthopedic surgeon about whether I was a candidate for that, much more so than having a cuff repair.
There's not going to be anything to repair the cuff too if she's had a shoulder replacement. It's not possible.
So I think that would probably be my next approach. And I think you're probably thinking, oh my gosh, another big surgery, things like that.
They're pretty good.
I think anecdotally, patients are very happy with a reverse total shoulder. What the reverse total shoulder does is it changes the ball and socket joint. So the ball is the socket and the socket is the ball. And so you can lift your arm overhead without your rotator cuff. That's the intent of a reverse total shoulder. So I think that'd be my first step, Peggy.
Yeah, I agree.
So talk to your orthopedic
surgeon and see if you're a candidate for a reverse total shoulder arthroplasty.
Keith emailed us to say when Keith walks downstairs, he gets a sharp pain on the outside or front side of their right ankle as the ankle flexes. Keith loses strength with the pain, and they're concerned about stability or falling issues.
Yeah, for sure.
Ideas.
Sounds like he's getting some impingement in the front of his ankle, so... Why is that? Is there some arthritis in the front of his ankle? So you can get bone spurs and arthritis in the front of your ankle. And as you flex, or we call it dorsiflex, especially going down a stair requires quite a bit of dorsiflexion range of motion. You can get impingement on the front side of your ankle and it hurts. And that can cause you to fall. So I guess my first step would be to see a PT to find out why your ankle range of motion is limited in that direction. Is there anything that can be done about it? And then there are options thereafter. You might need a shoe with a heel lift that gives you a little bit more room so you don't have to dorsiflex quite as much. You might need some strengthening. You might need an orthotic in your shoe depending upon what they find. It's hard to say what exactly you need, but I understand what's happening, and you should see somebody before you fall.
Question on email, what do you say to patients claiming their pain went away after using some form of a placebo?
Fantastic.
Wonderful.
Let me know if you need anything else from me.
Great. It's all good. So again, it gets into the whole evidence-based practices. There's research, there's clinical expertise, and then there's those patients' values or beliefs. And how much those things weigh with a patient is anybody's guess. And maybe that treatment worked because the patient laid in a certain position that was helpful for their back. Maybe it wasn't the treatment itself. Who knows? But if it works, I always like to hear a little bit more about it. And I always put it in the back of my mind in case I see someone with a similar condition and ask them a little bit about, well, have you ever thought about or consider this? So, no, I think it's great. I don't care if a patient gets better as long as they get better.
Right, right. And I always, again, like to encourage them to continue exercising.
Right.
You've made it this far. Whatever you did, treatment X that you chose got you better. Well, let's make sure you stay better by doing this stretching, doing this warm-up, doing this strengthening exercise, kind of like you, Larry, with your five-pound weights next to your chair. Like, just make sure that you that this doesn't come back.
Right. No offense. We never want to see you again. That's what I always tell my patients. I want them to be independent in managing their condition. I want them to know if they get a little flare-up, how they should fix it. Mm-hmm. So I don't mean that maliciously, but as like I've done my job.
Right. That's a great point also, in that sometimes patients will come back with a little flare. Mm-hmm. Maybe they did something over the weekend. They feel like they're disappointing us.
Right, like a tail between the knee, between the legs. Oh, I've done bad.
But I love that because it's a teachable moment.
Right.
I would rather somebody had a flare while they were under my care, so I could coach them through that. So then the next time it happens, they don't panic. They know exactly what to do to recover. It's all part of learning how to manage what we see in the world now, mostly chronic conditions.
And I think it also just emphasizes the importance of being honest. Because we may have said, you know, well, I don't quite think you're ready to run. And then we'll get somebody who'll come in and they'll be looking down and not making eye contact with you. And they'll say, how do you feel? And they'll say, I feel really pretty good. And I'll say, okay. And they say, but I did try running. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, maybe you're, and it was fine. Maybe you're a little bit more ready for it than we thought. So let's now try and work this into your rehab program and see if we can kind of get you moving along a little bit more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So I want people to be honest. So.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, I love it when they say, can I do such and such? And I'd say, oh, probably not yet. And they say, well, I did it yesterday.
Okay. And we learn a lot from people.
Yes.
We learn a lot from people who stretch into things that maybe we think they're not ready for because we don't know everything. And in general, we're going to take a more conservative approach.
So if you stick your toe in, just be honest.
Yeah,
that's all we need.
Be honest.
Yep.
There are times I can tell you from experience that having the 5 pound weights next to the chair doesn't all if you don't notice or don't think about it. Just having them there
doesn't do the job. So after a while, it's just like another piece of furniture, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you don't even see them anymore.
Right.
You should have little blinking lights on them or something. Or something like
or
the refrigerator that screams, eat me, eat me, like, pick me up,
right,
pick me
exactly.
up.
I have not left the ground for 3 days.
We should invent that. Let's do that.
Oh, man.
Put a motion sensor in them. And the weight hasn't been moved in 3 days,
there
is a little alarm.
Yeah.
JD emailed to say she heard us talking about an email address for an exercise program. We gave it, but could you please repeat that email address? Remember?
That was the ACSM.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the American College of Sports Medicine, A, C as in cat, S as in Sam, M as in mom, .org. And it doesn't tell you what to do. It tells you what sort of the goals, the big picture, how many minutes of cardio, how many minutes of flexibility and balance, how many minutes of resistive training. And it varies depending upon the intensity. So it lays that out for you as well. But it's the American College of Sports Medicine.
ACSM.org.
And there's a drop down that says education and resources. So that'd probably be where you'd want to go.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Janet in Marshfield, your turn. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I fell down my upstairs steps in April of 23, and I only cracked two bones in my neck, the C2 C2 and C3. So after a month, I started getting shocks in my face and forehead, so I had to go in, and guess what? The bones moved, so I had to have surgery May 1st. Anyway, I thought that would all take care of all the problem.
But it hasn't.
No, and I'm still in therapy pretty much all the time for one thing or another. But my neck, after they bolted, put it together, the screws and stuff, the bones, the cervical bones beneath it all collapsed.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
good grief.
Yeah. And then I had a compression fracture in my lowest thoracic bone the year before that, and had my doctor said, well, you shouldn't have gotten that. I had you on the right medicine. Well, I did. Now what? So I'm either in for my back, or now I'm in because they said I'm too unsteady to walk alone. I have to take my cane, and then I have to have cataract surgery soon, and they want me to use a walker, and I'm just feeling so disabled all of a sudden.
Yeah,
that's
no kidding.
Lot. This is a lot in 2 years.
Yeah,
it's a lot.
I like hearing you talk about using a walker because I don't feel like a cane is going to be sufficient for you based upon the things that you have told me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after your cataract surgery, I think it'd be useful to think about getting in a pool. It can unweight your spine. It sounds like you have a lot of spine problems. You know, once they fuse 2, 3, then you just end up getting sequential failure at the other levels that are being overworked. And then you have your thoracic stuff and you have your instability. You could work on all those things in a pool to help maintain your strength, your balance, because otherwise you're right. You're feeling sort of deteriorated, probably weak and unstable. And the pool can help you rebuild strength and balance. So I would hope that you could find something close by.
Right. And between cataract surgery and all of her osteoporotic fractures or traumatic fractures, she's at a great risk for a fall.
Absolutely.
And vision, as we know, plays an important role in balance. And so I know the idea of walking with a walker probably sounds very defeating, but from a safety perspective, after cataract surgery and things like that, I think it's a really good idea, and Lori has her finger up. She's got she's got more.
Well, the other thing about a walker is it may allow you to walk longer distances.
Right.
So if you are unable to walk long distances with the cane due to pain, instability, whatever, a walker may allow you to walk longer and farther, and that's going to be better for your health.
I just went online quickly, and I think the Marshfield Clinic has a pool. So
great!
Oh yeah,
wonderful.
Yeah,
wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be
so
great.
That would
That's
be
a great choice for you.
Give that a shot, Janet.
Yeah.
I have a relative who's complains about having to use a walker because she says I can walk just fine without one. But
oh yeah,
she's 85, and she
go ahead.
You're one fall away from a hip fracture,
correct,
and the 1 year mortality on a hip fracture is pretty darn high.
Correct.
So,
yeah,
my father-in-law has been instructed to take his cane with him when he goes on a walk, and so he carries it.
He carries it. I can totally see that with Richard.
Yeah. So,
Grant emailed to say is 74 years old, good health and good shape, fractured the neck of their left humerus 2 weeks ago. The docs at the ER put Grant's arm in a sling. Grant will not see the orthopedic until September 2nd. Should Grant do any PT exercises before seeing the doctor? And if so, what kinds of exercises?
So he definitely needs to get his elbow out of that sling and make sure he can bend and straighten his elbow, because you can end up with an elbow flexion contracture just from being in that sling. Needing to do wrist range of motion, pronation and supination, like you pretend you're starting a car, things like that. So I don't know. I don't want to make any recommendations for shoulder range of motion because I don't know if he's displaced.
If it displaced at all. Yeah.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
September 2nd seems like a long time to wait to see.
Well, today's the what?
When did he fall?
20.
2 weeks ago.
So that's like a month.
Yeah, that is kind of long.
That seems long to me. So, yeah, but anyway.
But anyway, yeah, get his elbow out of the
get
sling.
Your elbow out of the mm-hmm. sling and get that elbow straight mm-hmm. and turn your palm up and palm mm-hmm. down. Wrist and finger range of motion.
You can grip a dish, yeah. just hold or grip right. like a dish right. rag or something like that while you're watching the mm-hmm. Brewer game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And turn your neck from side to mm-hmm. side because you want to work above and below that fracture.
Linda in Appleton, we'll go to you now. Hi, Linda.
Okay, hi, Larry. Thank you, and thank you, girls, for always. 2-3 years ago, I had plantar fasciitis pretty bad, and the podiatrist gave me a couple of cortisone shots, and they worked. The third shot didn't work. So then I went to a chiropractor. And so after a couple of sessions, he moved the three toes, you know, the middle toes, toward the body, not away from the body, but toward the body. And then it didn't really bother me that day, but the next day, when I heard I went back to him and I said, please do not touch my toes. Because ever since then, I've had radiating pain at night only when I'm prone, you know, and laying down, mm-hmm. Goes up to the hip area, almost to the hip area. Very, very tight. It's not a Charlie horse because I've had those, but it's when I'm upright, sitting, standing in the morning when you get going, it doesn't hurt at all. But I stretch in the morning then, you know, to get it going and get the, it's only the one leg,
mm-hmm.
but I know it all came from those. I think moving those toes.
So when you say laying prone, you're like your toes are pointed.
Plantar flexed,
right?
So when you said that the chiropractor moved your toes towards your brain, so move them up toward the ceiling? Is that
what
you're saying?
That's what I'm thinking.
I just want to make sure I have
toward
that right.
Toward my body.
Towards your body.
Toward the ceiling.
Toward the ceiling. Okay.
So they got mobilized anteriorly, and now when she tries to go posteriorly, they're not going that way?
I don't know, unless that pulled on like S2, you know, S1, S2.
I didn't think about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, was your ankle dorsiflex? Was your ankle? Yeah. I don't know.
So it might be worth seeing a physical therapist to see if they can see if she needs some neuromobilization
right.
or neuroflossing or something.
Yeah.
Like
it
that.
Just seems odd that you feel it up to your hip. That's the part that has me a bit troubled. So the idea would be to see a PT and see if the PT can reproduce the symptoms.
Right.
It needs to be replicated, and then the PT needs to move your hip, move your knee, move your ankle and foot to sort out the source of that pain.
Yeah, it seems unlikely to be the sciatic nerve if she's in plantar flexion when she feels
it. If she's in plantar flexion,
what about
something around the fibular head?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know, maybe.
Oh.
Yeah, I think you need to see a PT. What? Oh, you just had an aha? She's looking aha.
The fibular nerve.
Oh.
Because you stretch it in plantar flexion and inversion.
Okay, all right.
So I wonder if it's something mm-hmm. to do with her fibular nerve.
Fibular nerve.
Otherwise known as the peroneal nerve.
Uh-huh. See a PT.
Yeah.
have them sort it out.
Yeah.
Linda, good luck.
That's what I do. Let us know what they find because we're super curious now.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bonnie in Lake Geneva, your turn. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. I had called before and I explained that I'd lost a lot of weight, 77 pounds, and that on the tennis court, I no longer had knee or ankle problems. But I called because when biking, I was having this problem with my left knee, and I used the word tweak.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, you guys advised me to check out the bike, you know, make sure I'm fitting it correctly. And I did that, and I no longer have any tweaking in my left knee. And so I'm calling to say big thank you.
Oh, hallelujah.
Well, you know, so this really brings up a good point of making sure that you're fit to the weight machine you're using, you're fit to the bike you're using, things like that. So mm-hmm. Lori and I did a 500-mile bike trip. That's where we called from last time, and we mm-hmm. saw a lot of people who didn't have their bikes fit, and we just wanted to hand out our business cards.
Oh, exactly.
But we didn't.
Well, if you go back to many of our conversations mm-hmm. today, you know, we go back to see the PT so we can find the source mm-hmm. of your problem. So, mm-hmm. like, we could have tried to give Bonnie some exercises for her knee or whatever, but that That's that, you know, that's not fixing the problem. And so sometimes when we say go see a PT, it's not because we don't want to tell you what our favorite exercises for condition X, Y, or Z might be. It's because, as you said at the top of the show, Jill, this exercise program is designed for you,
right,
and your particular problem. But a piece of that is knowing what caused it in the first place.
Right, exactly. Well, I'm so glad for Bonnie, though. Yeah. This is amazing.
Thanks, Bonnie. Yeah, appreciate it. Well, here's another one. Barbara in Middleton emailed to say 11 years ago, Barbara was hit, a car hit her, with multiple fractures, spent a month at the UW hospital, 3 months in inpatient rehab. Mm. If it weren't for the excellent care of PTs and OTs, they said they would not have been able to return to live independently. Barbara continues to seek their treatment when needed. So if anyone is questioning whether these providers can be of any help, Barbara says, don't wait, make an appointment.
Oh, nice. That's great. That's wonderful.
That's great.
Wonderful.
Love that.
Wonderful.
Barbara, thank you so much for that comment. And thanks for all of the comments that we've had today. It's been a lot of fun, as always.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm guessing we'll do this again next
month, probably. We will, yes.
Probably
exactly.
Next month, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sounds like a plan.
Be there or be square.
Exactly.
Thanks, Laura. Thanks, Jill. Laurie Tyne Brody, physical therapist at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic, and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program. And they come by once a month to talk about aches and pains and dealing with them. It's always fun. And they'll be back in probably almost exactly a month from today, and we will do this all over again. Coming up next, we're going to talk about the Erie Canal with author Lori Lawler. Her new book is titled Many Voices, Building Erie, the Canal That Changed America. It's a fascinating book. I'm Larry Mueller. The Erie Canal, Bruce Springsteen singing for us there. 200 years ago, the 363-mile Erie Canal opened up the interior of the United States, had a big impact on the whole country and certainly on Wisconsin. It was the largest public works project ever attempted, and its impact on the country was really big. And here to talk about it is Lori Lawler, back with us, author of the new book, Many Voices, Building Erie. Many Voices, Building Erie, the Canal That Changed America. So maybe you visited the Erie Canal in upstate New York. Do you know how it was constructed a couple hundred years ago, or the impact it had on the U.S. and our economy? I hope you'll join in. Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Lori Lawler, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm really excited. This is kind of a double birthday for the 200th birthday of the finishing up the canal. And also my book is coming out tomorrow. So it's having its birthday too, which is wonderful.
I was really glad to get an advance reader copy of it because I wondered, you know, I don't know anything about the Erie Canal. And I learned so much about so many different, not only the canal itself, but what life was like then and how it affected so many different people, men and women, native tribes. It was just a fascinating read. But I'm wondering, how did you come to write the book?
Well, it really was a Wisconsin-originated idea. I was working on another book about a environmental project out in Waukesha County, which was renovating an 8-acre garbage dump and making it into this wonderful nature refuge. And while I was doing that, I came upon a very early Wisconsin settler named John Griffin. And he had his land right near where I was doing some research. And his story really made me start to think. He came to Wisconsin in 1846, and he traveled across the Atlantic. He was only 52 years old at the time, and he was a young man.
Yeah.
He came across, and he boarded a ship at New York Harbor, went up the Hudson River, got to Albany, and then got a ride on the Erie Canal. And he went across, all the way across to Buffalo on the shores of Lake Erie, and then he made his way up in a schooner up the St. Clair River to the Detroit River to the Upper Great Lakes. And then he finally made it to Milwaukee, where he hired a wagon. He ended up in Waukesha County, filed on 112 acres of tall grass prairie. And his story and his letters are so poignant. He's in Wisconsin, right?
Yeah.
And he's writing home to England, and he's kind of homesick. And he writes, though, "I am as good as any man here. I like the look of the country. I shall live and die in this new place." But he was trying to get his relatives to come over, and he kept saying, "You know, the Erie Canal is my favorite part of the ride here," because there was little possibility of drowning. So, yeah, you know, after the Atlantic. But for folks who may not know a lot about the canal, it was very simple. At the time, it was looked at as an engineering marvel, but it's basically 4 feet deep, 40 feet wide, and it went 363 miles across upstate New York. And it transported goods, people, immigrants, tourists on flat-bottom boats. And these boats were pulled by horses.
Horses, yeah.
Right. So,
and somebody had to be holding on to those horses.
Exactly. And often they were children that would be walking along trying to keep everything untangled. So the fastest you could go was 4 miles an hour. It was very slow. But I think, really, the fascinating connection with Wisconsin is that so many people came across the Atlantic, came across the Erie Canal, up through the Great Lakes, places like Milwaukee, Chicago, Toledo, Ohio, Duluth, Minnesota, Marquette, all had their beginnings because of a population surge. And I love this one quote from a writer who said that beer may have made Milwaukee famous, but it was the Erie Canal that made Milwaukee in the first place. So,
I love that.
Yeah, so we get kind of a connection there with all these people. It was a huge jump in population from 1835, which was basically 10 years after the canal was finished. There were only 11,000 people in Wisconsin. By 1850, there were 305,000. So yeah. it really helped kind of spread population, people farming, getting jobs in cities.
You know, it really was fascinating to me to read your book. I hope a lot of people read it. You describe the canal, or you describe the area, as being, let's see, how shall I put it? Lower on the east side and higher on the west side as you got to Lake Erie.
Right.
So there was quite an elevation shift upward.
Right.
And there's no machinery here. We're talking people and axes and
shovels, lots of shovels. Yes, exactly. And I think that's a really good point, because at the moment they decided to try this project that everybody thought was sheer madness, the upstate New York was pretty wild. It was a landscape that there were hardly any roads.
Corduroy roads, they called them. Exactly. Just logs that were laid across the mud.
Right. And so they had to go up cliffs. They had to blast through dolomite cliff faces. They had to go over mountains. They had to get around whitewater. So one of the things that really makes the story so suspenseful for me as a writer, really intriguing, was they had to come up with 8 locks, you know, to actually elevate the boats to get them across that elevation shift, and 18 aqueducts, which are those major giant bridges that would carry. They were sort of viewed as like tourist attractions once they got the thing going. So there were huge amounts of quicksand. They had all kinds of issues with trying to get across. And I think what's amazing to me is that at the point where they decided to try this, there were no trained engineers in America.
Yeah, not a single one.
Not one, and no engineering schools, which is kind of amazing also. They only had, as you said, they had shovels, they had picks, they had animals pulling wagons, they had wheelbarrows, and that was it, and saws.
Well, there was a guy by the name of Elkin Watson who was, he was the guy that saw it through right from beginning to end. He was a really interesting guy, a very smart guy.
And
started a whole bunch of things. I think he started the free public school system was his idea.
Yeah. Well, I think, and DeWitt Clinton was also another enormously amazing people. And that's, you know, that there's the technical part that really intrigued me, but also the people, you know. And there were so many heroes who we don't even know about. Who did amazing things. So there was another very young man who's only 26. His name was Canvas White. Yeah. And he was self-taught, a surveyor and a mathematician. And he decided when he got the job that he didn't know how to build a canal.
So he'd never seen one.
No. So he goes on his own dime. He goes to England. He tries to see as many canals as he can. In Europe, there are many canals. And so he tried to see how they built aqueducts, how they built locks. But the main thing that he discovered when he was there that makes him really heroic is he found a recipe for waterproof cement, which they didn't have here. So that would, all those locks that had stones that were put together with stone had to be glued together or stuck together with something, and he was the one who he basically saved the day.
And there was originally Watson had proposed 62 locks. I think they didn't wind up with that many.
No, but they didn't. But the Europeans, they asked if they'd come over and help, and they were like, "No way, this project is too crazy." So the Americans were really on their own, and I think what I really love about the story is with sort of that go-ahead anyway view of engineers like Canvas White and Elkanah Watson, like just go ahead and try it and make mistakes and see if you can pull it off. And even though they didn't really know what they were doing, they managed somehow.
And it was interesting to me that they tried to get some federal support for it, and the government said, "No, this is your dime to spend." And so the state of New York fronted all the cost for it.
Right.
It was, so he comes up with like an idea for 3 sections.
Right.
He's got, and he starts in the middle.
Right.
And there was some politics going on there that helped him out with that middle section.
Yeah. DeWitt Clinton was a very clever politician, and he was a good PR man. He knew if he started at either end, the eastern section or the western section, it would be really rough because there
hard.
Was... Yeah, exactly. But the middle section was the easiest. So he thought, if I get that done, I show everybody we did it, he'll get more enthused to support, he'll get tax dollars, people will be excited about investing. So that's why they did it that way. But the whole thing became like a race for time because he had in his mind 4th of July. He wanted to get it all done by the 4th of July.
Well, we're talking about years.
Years and years, like 7 years.
But he
years.
Wanted it done on the 4th of July, the year that it was done.
Yes, he did. That was his goal because he wanted to run for president. So that was his plan. Which he never succeeded in doing, unfortunately, because he died before he could do it. But it's kind of, I think there were a lot of really remarkable people involved.
There were indeed, and the challenges as you described them were how they overcame various parts along the way. It's just fascinating reading, and the workers, the laborers, who built the Erie Canal, many of them were Irish descent.
Exactly. And at one point, there were as many as 3,000 people per day working on it. The story that the politicians and the investors told was that it was all built by native-born Americans, which was not true. I mean, the immigrants were absolutely essential, and they really risked their lives. They got cholera. They got yellow fever in some of the swampy areas. And the worst accidents often happened because of explosives. They didn't have TNT. They had just black powder. So they would set these rocks with the explosive.
Dig a hole and...
Yeah, exactly. And then they'd go every direction, the explosion. So it was a very dangerous job, and we don't even know their names. A lot of them went unrecorded.
And the families, many of them, wives and kids came along. The wives worked, but they had to, none of them were paid extra.
Right.
So the wives had to develop their own little jobs and so forth along the way.
Right. A lot of them would put up kind of boarding houses, so to speak, more like shacks. They'd put up workers there. They'd do cooking, laundry. Kids they had a really hard job. They were called jigger bosses. They would bring whiskey and water to the workers on the lines. So the kids were also really part of it. They were also used as powder monkeys. They would carry some of these explosives. And it was very dangerous. There was no health insurance. There was no, if you got killed.
And there was no child labor law either.
No,
so the kids were working at very young ages.
Yeah, they could be 6 or 8 or 9. So it was, as you say, it was a kind of a family operation. And then later when the canal got going, the boats were often owned by families, and they would have, you know, the father might be the captain, and maybe the mother would also help with the captain work. And then she would be the cook, and the kids would have various jobs on the boat as well. So, but I think the real sad part in looking at some of these stories was looking at the Haudenosaunee, mentioned.
And we'll get to that. I just want to remind you that we are talking with Lori Lawler today about her book. It's titled Many Voices, Building Erie, the Canal That Changed America. It goes on for sale tomorrow, you'll be able to get a copy. If you have a question right now, I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we visit with author Lori Lawler about her book, Many Voices, Building Erie, the Canal That Changed America. Again, you can join in 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. One of the things I was glad you wrote about was the impact on Indigenous folk, the Haudenosaunee, which was, a sort of a confederation of 7 tribes throughout that area.
Yeah, it was really an unusual alliance, and there were actually 6 tribes altogether. You might have heard of them as the Iroquois Confederacy, but they were the Mohawk, the Oneida, the Onondaga, the Cayuga, Seneca, and Tuscarora, and they had this cooperative government set up where they would help each other in times of war, and they would counsel with each other to decide if they were going to war. But what was really interesting to me was the role of women in this culture, this Indigenous culture, because they actually had quite a bit of power. And they were, some feminists later say that they were inspired by the way in which women played a very active role in treaty making, in deciding if a nation would go to war, and what would happen with farms, what would happen with housing. So they were really kind of liberated it very early.
Yeah, and some women even wrote about it, as you point out in the book, and I, as I recall.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Well, the entire economic impact of this cannot be, as you so rightfully point out, cannot be underestimated.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I think that that economic impact also was reflected in the ways in which it changed the way we communicate. And then some people will say that the Erie Canal was sort of like the first superhighway. It was the first internet in a way, because ideas and books and speakers were going east-west along the canal. They were coming, all these things were coming with books, pamphlets, but they were also carrying mail, sort of like our emails today. You know, the fact that you could have this way to communicate with people that you left hundreds of miles away and came to Wisconsin, that there was a way to get back to communicate. And I think that really had a huge impact as well.
Well, and to put it in terms, you talk about the amount of time prior to the canal being constructed to after it was constructed was not a question of just days. It was like weeks.
Yes. Yeah. You could be traveling for months, and depending on the weather, right? If it was raining, if it was snowing. The thing about the canal is that it was only operating when it was spring and summer. In winter, it froze. So yeah. About 20 years after the canal, the railroads came in, and then they sort of created a more constant transportation for folks. But the Erie Canal maintained its viability as a heavy hauler, and it was hauling very heavy freight back and forth. Originally, it was hauling salt, it was hauling lumber, and then bringing out west to places like Wisconsin, finished goods, pianos, boots, all that kind of plows. And so it was this kind of back and forth that really, it really changed America, and it really brought America together, especially in the North, which had enormous impact during the Civil War.
And you mentioned salt, and salt was also important for the development of the canal.
Yes, exactly.
Explain that.
Yeah, this was a really interesting thing. Out in western New York, there are some of the biggest salt deposits in the United States. And so they'd been trying to, it's a pretty arduous process of changing salt into something people can use, because it has to be boiled down. But salt was used to preserve meat. It was used in medicines. It was used all different sorts of ways, and it was really important. So salt sort of made the Erie Canal, because they realized there was no way to get these amazing salt deposits back east. And so they realized that was another huge reason to push through the canal, you know. And it was something as simple that we take for granted, right? Salt.
Yeah, and yet it played this enormous role. Dave in Janesville called, couldn't stay with us, but asks if the path of the canal can be traveled today. Are there boat, bike, or car tours of the Erie Canal? And you, obviously, you visited the Erie Canal, but talk about that aspect of it.
Well, I think this is what's so remarkable about this entire transformation, because the Erie Canal today is part of a National Heritage Corridor. So you can kayak in the canal, you can follow the towpaths for biking, for hiking. They have really tried very hard to make this kind of a green space between communities out in the northern part of New York. And so actually in September, there's a World Canal Conference that I'm going to be participating in. People from all over the world are coming in to celebrate the 200th anniversary of the canal, and also to talk about and to visit and to tour in boats the canal today. So, yes, it's absolutely possible. And it's people have written about it. And it's a very remarkably peaceful way to travel.
Yeah, and the original canal, lots of the original canal, of course, is gone.
It is, and it's been transformed multiple times, made bigger and bigger as it became more and more popular. They kept widening it and kind of changing the route. So I was really excited to be able to go out and see the original part of it and then how it grew. So it's kind of a living thing in that it just when everyone thought it was over, somebody thought of a new way to kind of resurrect it. So it's a kind of an interesting story.
It is absolutely a fascinating story to me. What struck you the most, or what maybe what surprised you the most in your research on this book? And we're just, believe me, we're just lightly touching on everything that's in this book.
Yeah, I think my one discovery I made that really really touched me was the people, the ordinary people in upstate New York. Who saw these workers coming in, and they were badly treated. You know, oftentimes they were sick. They would be injured. There was a woman, and her name was Edna Smith, and she and her Quaker husband ran a hospital in their own house.
Yeah.
And she was out in Lockport, which probably was the most dangerous section because they had to create what they called the Flight of Five. Five locks, one on top of the other, like a stair step up the side of this extremely steep cliff. She wrote about her experiences, and I'm so grateful she did that because we get a sense of who she was, who her husband was, but then who these people were, who were often nameless and faceless, who did this really hard work of building the canal.
And as I'm trying to remember, there's a photo in the book. There are many really nice photos and artists and drawings and so forth that artists had done over the years that really give you an idea. Those five steps,
yeah,
I think, are in here.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And they did it like it's almost like an S. If you can imagine an escalator, it's like a two-way escalator, one going up, one going down, and the boats would go in. And locks are really fascinating. I've always been really interested in them, the way they operate to use gravity and to use buoyancy to raise up a boat to the next level and then open the gates and then it goes on to the next level.
It's, the photo is fascinating, yeah. of that whole process and the water, actually the gravity, it was fairly quick if you come to think about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it kind of, it worked, but it really was, based on, an idea. The gate itself was quite ancient. Leonardo da Vinci is the one who invented and drew the first gate that was used for locks, and because of keeping the water in, keeping the water out. But it was very exciting. People, even today, people love to watch locks. When I was growing up, we would go on camping trips with my family, and we would go up to Sault Ste. Marie
and watch
and just watch locks. My mother thought it was the most boring thing in the world, but we loved it.
Lori, you have written a fascinating book. Thank you so much for writing it. I hope you sell a whole bunch of copies.
I
loved it. I loved it very much. Lori Lawler, her book is, again, titled Many Voices, Building Erie the Canal That Changed America. Fascinating read, and I hope you get a chance to see it. And thanks again to our producers. It's a big team effort always. Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.